There's something pretty amazing about the front row there, sitting and hearing the singers, and then everybody behind me singing. It's like you're surrounded in worship. Maybe that's why the front row is so valuable. I don't know. There's a lot of seats here that we could take. I'm appreciative of Pastor John. He allows me to come and basically serve a little more than just serving, playing guitar over there. And I appreciate you guys. I love this church. I grew up in this church, been in this church for 38 years. And if I didn't, I would not wear this very uncomfortable uniform to remind everybody of what I do when I'm away. You notice that I'm away quite a bit. That spot's empty, and it's usually because I'm gone to my own congregation of soldiers. But this church, I was ordained in this church. This church made me a center point pastor, and then they sent me out to be a chaplain in the Army. About 100 days a year or so, and lots of hotel rooms and tents, and I'm not much on camping myself, actually, but I did it enough, actually, growing up. But I want to talk a little bit before I get into my sermon, just bring you up to speed a little. This slide here is casualty notification class. One of the things I do is I notify families when there's a casualty. If you have ever seen the movies, Taking Chance is a good one, actually, to see this. But you'll see two guys in this uniform walk up to a door and knock on it. And that's something that I have the honor of doing. It's not something that I like to do. It's one of the hardest things, I would say, about being a military chaplain, and it's one of the most beautiful things about being a military chaplain. To allow somebody to cry on your shoulder or to punch you in the chest or just sit and be quiet with them. And then I finally can ask that question of, well, just tell me a little bit about your son. Tell me a little bit about your daughter. And then the healing process starts from that point on. And it's pretty amazing. But this is a group that was being trained in the casualty notification. This is me right here with what we're holding there. Comes from Center Point Church and from the Prayers and Squares group. And Susan McAdams sent me a list, and I don't have it on me, but there's a group of ladies that make these squares for me, and I hand these things out, and they have a verse on the back of them, and the soldiers will carry them in their pockets in their battle dress uniforms, and they just feel like the Lord is watching over them. I know that Ellen Charnley's one of those ladies, Susan's one of those ladies, Emmy Cool. I don't have them memorized, but I'm so appreciative of the partnership that I have in this community and in this church. That's the first slide there. Me with one of the first sergeants there, Command Sergeant Major now, and he takes a lot on his shoulders as well. So it'll be a chaplain and a Command Sergeant Major, or a chaplain and a colonel. But a chaplain is always there. When the colonel reads or doesn't read, he memorizes the statement that we say, and then after that, the chaplain just kind of takes over, because after that's when the breakdown is, or even before. On one of them, the person that we were going to, the lady who lost her husband, I could see her in the window, and she looked out, and she just dropped her glass of tea and just fell, and then couldn't answer the door for a little while. But it's good to go with the sergeant major. It's good to go with the colonels and the captains and the majors, and be a partner and be in prayer for those guys as they announce. And that's one of the duties I do. And I like to start with just a little bit of what I do, because there's so many new people that come to Pagosa every year. Or you just don't even realize that I do this work based on you guys sending me out and supporting me in your prayers. And I know there's people here that pray for me every single day. It's felt. One of the things I do is memorial services, just like a regular pastor would. We care for we honor our dead, care for our wounded, and we serve those that are living. And we always set up a stand with their Kevlar, their helmet, their ID tags. We used to call them dog tags. We call them ID tags now because we're a kinder, gentler army. And their boots and a flag, and we present that flag to the survivors. We sometimes just hold them right there. We hold them in a chapel, or we hold them in the unit, right there with our helicopters, and they just drag a podium out for me and allow me to say a few words to honor the folks that were there to remember. And there's a wider shot of the unit praying with me. And you can see up there in the front my laser won't. Oh, there we go. Right there is that stand. And at the very end, we'll go up there and we will pay our final respects one by one. We'll go up and salute that stand. I'm involved with ceremonies. So this is a change of command ceremony. We have two commanders. One is leaving and one's coming in. And so I'll do a benediction and invocation and a short message there. I love how the military, the Army, allows chaplains to freely share a message at these ceremonies and expects us to do that. We go to balls. This is the Army Aviation Ball, and I open that ball with a blessing, and it's a good time for all, and it's a great time of camaraderie. We're all dressed up in our blues, and we give out awards. We recognize the service that we've done, the deployments we've done, that kind of thing. But part of that, it's the chance for Melanie to be a princess for a day or for a night and dress up in a gown. And she would tell us she's not a princess. We're really just a couple goofballs, as what's in that second picture there, who we really are. But we sure can fake everybody out like we're, you know, some sort of royalty walking into that ball and being announced. And another thing that I do is marriage retreats. I did, for 7 years straight, I did 6 to 8 of these a year. And it's a 3-day event. Friday night we meet, and then we take them through a 3-day curriculum to teach people how to be married again after not seeing each other for 15 months of deployment. And it's very good for the couples. We do the same thing with families. We have a family retreat, and we teach parents how to raise children and kids how to be kids, and we come up with a motto by the end of that Sunday. We come up with a motto that really works to for us. For example, ours is Cowans Never Give Up, and it's a good motto. We've used it so many times. We've used it when Tyler, my older son, broke his femur in a football game, and I was the athletic director, and of course went out there and just held his hand, and I said, "What do Cowans do?" And he just over and over and all the way over to the ambulance ride, "What do Cowans do?" And he would just repeat, "Cowans never give up." It's something that we point at. If you have teenagers and they somehow disappoint you or break the rules or whatever, instead of waiting for them to come in at 1 o'clock in the morning and yelling at them and causing some sort of uproar that causes damage between you and your own daughter, your own son, you can put them to bed, and they know there's going to be a talk tomorrow. But it's a talk where we point at our motto, and we say, we built that motto over a 3-day period. We identified our values, and then we came up with a family motto. You're a part of that. So what part did you break? What part did you not live up to? We need to talk about that. And yeah, there's a consequence, and we can make that a logical consequence, but that's a better way of dealing with somebody who, at that point, is probably a little too big to get the old cinch strap that we had when my boys had. they like to be reasoned with at that age, you know, and understand why you're disappointed. But that's at one of the places we go there. That's me just giving who knows what, but one of the modules. I also go to deployment trainings. This was back in December, and I was there to give a deployment briefing. Unfortunately, I'm also, I don't like this part, but I'm glad that chaplains do it. With all the spouses there, we tell them what happens when there's a casualty, what they should expect. And so I was so glad that I had these prayer squares, and the spouses, you can see the looks on their face, They were so glad to get to go up there and get one of those. In my mind, I started this with, I will give these to the soldiers. That quickly morphed into kids, sons and daughters, and wives and husbands saying, yeah, I'd really like one of those too. And so I asked for 300 of them from our ladies. And I thought, man, what are they going to say when I say 300? And they didn't really bat an eye. So Susan just gave me a bag full again today that's January's delivery. So we do that. It's been quite a little deal for me this past few months as we do this. This is right after a memorial ceremony. I gathered that company that lost a soldier and just explained what these were, and they gratefully grabbed onto this and took a picture with them. They wanted a picture, and so I took a picture of them. One of them said, "Chaplain, you should get in the picture. Just let an atheist take the picture." They're a bunch of jokesters. I mean, we have fun in the military, and I love humor myself. I'm not, I guess, a typical pastor. I'm not so straight-laced that I don't appreciate some good humor. So I get to go flying, and the air crews love it when the chaplain flies with them. They just love it. They pick me up here in Pagosa, and that's out at the airport there. And we went flying around a little bit, and they love taking the chaplain on the training missions. They think I'm some sort of talisman is what it is, which is disappointing to me. I'm not a rabbit's foot. But they kind of view me that way in some ways. And that's fine because it's an opening. I can talk to them because they're open to me. and then I couldn't do this without, of course, the support system that I have that begins with my wife, who really is a princess, even though she'd tell you she's not. But she's a wonderful prayer warrior, and she supports me. She goes with me to marriage retreats when she can, and cares for my boys when I'm gone. And there's a lot of support that I have. These two guys right here are incredible, my sons, and I do miss their stuff. And it's really cool. Melanie, she clipped her phone onto her video camera recently and started filming the game so they could Facebook or FaceTime with me. And I can watch her phone, her phone scrolls up and down the court and during the football game. So I got to see Cade play football this year when I was gone, and I got to see the basketball games when I'm gone. And now she's figured out how to do a YouTube Live, and it's even better quality, and a lot of people can watch it. So we find our ways to manage and to make sure that I'm not missing in my son's lives, but that I'm always a part of it. And that things go on that we want to go on. For example, Cade killed his first deer this year, and I wasn't able to be there. But I was able to set it up and say, hey, this is going to happen for you. And one of his coaches took him out for me and made it too easy. I would have walked him into the woods a lot longer than than that coach did. So he really appreciates it. But those guys are amazing. And then I have my extended family, and that's my mom. She's a prayer warrior. My in-laws, Brenda and Sanford, they are so supportive of what I do, and they know the sacrifice, that the time away from the family and the things. They, I believe, know the burden that kind of falls on you sometimes, and I think their prayers, your prayers, my wife's prayer, my sons pray for me all the time. That helps those burdens just lift so I can just keep going and help the next set of people, the next soldier. So I'm not here to talk about that, though, today. I just wanted to remind everybody that I'm a part of this church, and you have sent me out as a missionary. And I appreciate the Lottie Moon offering, because missions do have to be supported, man. It's hotels for me and gas for me, and the Army doesn't pay for that. It's uniforms and... there's a lot to do when you're a missionary, and you need to be about the work of God, not worrying about how am I gonna get there to do the work. So I so appreciate everything that you guys have done. I love that I have an office here that all of my military junk is in, and it's not in my house. And I can come here and I can pull out an old binder on apologetics that I went through in seminary and just sit in there and just read it a little bit. Sit in there and pray without anybody really bothering me. It's so much more quiet here than it is in my office at school and being a principal. That place is a lot more active, I should say. But I'm here to bring a message today, not to talk about the military. I just wanted to remind you and thank you. So I appreciate it. But the message I want to talk about is called Wake Up. And it's out of Revelation 3. So if you want to go to Revelation 3, and we'll go through a few verses there. we'll get into a message and remind you that this is what I do in the military. You know, it's outside of being a bad guitar player here, this is what I do. So in one way, besides just serving on the worship team here, this is one way that I can practice my faith and worship with you guys. And this church is amazing. This message is about discipleship. It's about worship. It's about being a Christian versus living a Christian lifestyle. And even in the prayer beforehand, I went back there to pray with the worship team. The prayer that I heard was, let not this just be a bunch of acts of putting some notes together. Don't let it be an act of singing. Let it be true worship. And that's what our church does. That's what our church does. And I think that I would like to begin just by thinking. Let me ask you a couple of questions to reflect on. Have you ever felt like you're just going through the motions in anything, you know, in life in general, in your jobs? You begin something in your life with enthusiasm and buy-in and motivation, and then over time it becomes kind of a rut. We call it I'm going to the grind again, right, to the workplace or whatever it may be for you. It's a routine that loses its meaning, just routine. You've got involved in something only to think later, did I really even know the motivation for what I got involved with when I jumped into this? Did I understand what it was I was getting into? And did I want to do it in the first place? Maybe you find yourself in that situation. And I want us to think about this a little bit today, and I want to challenge you in your life wherever you are, with your service, your families, your jobs, but especially in your faith. And it's a good time of year to do that. Man, I love the new year because it's a good time for new beginnings. And it is a good time to commit to doing something. You don't have to make resolutions, but, you know, hopefully here we are at the end of January, mid to end. I hope that those of you who did are still trucking on, hanging in there. And I hope that those of you who just reflected without making any resolutions, but just reflected and said, what can I do this year to be closer to God, to know my God better, to serve my God better? I want to encourage you. This is a perfect time to start. Tomorrow is a perfect time to start. Yesterday was a perfect time to start. Right now is a perfect time to start. And it just starts with little incremental things, and I'll give you a few of those at the end here. But I want us to think this through a little bit, and I want to challenge you. This is the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. It's a letter that the Apostle Apostle John wrote while imprisoned. He was banished to the island of Patmos by the Roman authorities for preaching the gospel. So towards the end of his life, and he's there, and he receives revelation, the revelation of Jesus Christ. And when pastors say revelation, people do get a little nervous that they might not understand the book. In general, when comparing this book with the rest of the Bible, people do tend to think that it's mysterious, it's cryptic, there's a lot of stuff in it I'm not going to understand. And I hope to encourage you today that God doesn't hide understanding of the word from our hearts. Instead, he instills understanding of the word in our hearts, okay? But we got to get into it. We got to get in the word so that we can internalize the wisdom he speaks and that it might develop into us using the gifts and talents that he provides to us to live out that word and to understand this is why we do these things. It's not because we're a club or something, right? And these are the rules of the club. But simply put, revelation means to unveil, to reveal, to expose some truth. And the book is full of all kinds of metaphor and symbolism as you get into it. But the part we look at today is pretty straightforward, as it opens up to just a simple address to some major churches that are very much representative of the New Testament world, but also very much representative of our world today. And John is asked to write down this revelatory information about the end times, the future, the past, the present, and puts it all together. It kind of wraps it all together for us. And Revelation is beautiful. If you just go into it just to study it, to read it, not, you're not going into it to see if Michael Jackson's the Antichrist, it'll make a lot more sense to you without that agenda ahead of time. Just study it. It's written after churches, these churches that, seven churches he talks to. And we're going to look at one of them. But it's written after these churches are established for quite a while. Christ had come. He was the baby in the manger that we celebrated last month. He was the teacher, the prophet, the Messiah. Then he was crucified and he died on the cross. He was resurrected, something we celebrate officially at Easter, but something we celebrate as Christians every day. And then he appointed apostles to spread the gospel message. And in so doing, churches were established. Paul had traveled extensively through the established Christian churches and established Christian churches all over Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. And I had the chance to go there through the military during Desert Storm and spent a little time in Turkey and ate some really good food and worked like crazy. And so now we read about that place 2,000 years later, which is astounding to me that we can take a book and 2,000 years later read it and it's still just as relevant as those people who went and got those letters and spread those letters around to the churches. And I hope that this time of year you can think with me, reflect with me where we're going this year. What kind of church will we be this year? What kind of church are we now? What kind of church can we become? Why do we serve? And in so doing, maybe wake up, if needed, and be reinvigorated, if needed, and move forward. And January is a great time to do that. The churches John writes to in the book of Revelation are often referred to as the loveless church, the persecuted church, the compromising church, the corrupt church, the dead church, the faithful church, and the lukewarm church. Think about maybe the churches you've been in. Think about your own life. We are the church. It's not this building. It's us. So where do you fit in on that list? Just with a brief headline right there before you even look at what the scripture says about them. Where do you fit in? So we are going to look at one church, the dead church. And let's take a look and see what Christ, through John's vision and writing, says about the dead church and what we can learn from it. When I came across this last year, I was reading in my studies, and I came across this chapter, and I could not get beyond it for a couple of months. I would still go on and still study other things, but I kept coming back to this. Almost every day, I'm coming back to this chapter, to this dead church, and thinking on it. And there's a reason for that, because as a chaplain, as a pastor, as a principal at the elementary school, things can become routine. Things can become rote. Things can become a list of things to do rather than an invigorating, exciting, purposeful life that's lived out because of what God has done. They can do that. So when I read Revelation 3, I thought, man, I've got to write about that a little bit. I've got to write a sermon about that. And get it out of me and speak it to my church so that we can be warned. And so let's look at that. Let's look at Revelation chapter 3. And to the angel of the church in Sardis write, the words of him who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works. You have the reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Wake up. Strengthen what remains and is about to die. For I have not found your works complete in the sight of my God. Remember then what you have received and heard. Keep it and repent. If you will not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what hour I will come against you. So John addresses the church in this letter. It's a church in Sardis. It's part of the Lydian kingdom. It's a cool city. It was a city that was a great city. Aesop from Aesop's Fables was a citizen of Sardis. There's some cool things about it. But it was also populated, the church was populated by unregenerate, unredeemed, and spiritually dead people. And those are just theological terms to say that most of these folks weren't there as a result of dedicating their lives to Christ and serving him. because of that, because of what he did for them. They're there mostly as a matter of membership, of doing some acts of service, belonging to a club, networking, business contacts. Or they had just simply grown up in this church full of traditions and what we're supposed to do and never bothered to ask questions, hey, why do we do this? Why are we doing these things? That's a danger, by the way, of our kids growing up in church. You wouldn't think there's a danger to growing up in church. If we don't constantly raise our kids to understand that the reason we sing up here is to offer praise and worship to God, it's not so we can hear the most beautiful voices in the church, then the reason that Pastor John speaks up here, why he prays up here, why we take communion, this is a traditional thing, right? There's a reason behind it. If we don't constantly tell our kids the reasons and we forget that, oh, they'll get it along the way, no, they can grow up and go, oh, that's something we did. Yeah, we checked that box, right? So we've got to be aware of that and raise our kids to understand. This church right here was relying upon its former fullness. It's like me going to the football game on Friday night and talk about how great I was as a running back 30 years ago. It's already done. You know, it's a long time ago. That fullness I experienced on the field, the excitement, that was a long time ago. So it doesn't do me any good just to sit there and talk about how great I was to the other three dads that are there laying in on the fence talking about the same thing, right? The church is 2 to 3 generations past the death of and resurrection of Christ. And when we look at what God says about it, we have to wonder, how in the world could it be dead in such a short time? How could it change so quickly? But I can tell you, in this world, a couple of generations is a long time. When we look back on it, we read it in a verse or two, like it's like right then. We got to realize that time passes through those verses. And I can tell you, just in the past, attending this church for 38 years, I've seen a world of change. The people who come and go, and new faces, and all the new people. I know James still thinks I'm new, and because his dad was one of the founders of the church. And, you know, I still think we have a new pastor, even though Pastor John has been here for a while, right? So it's all a matter of perspective, but things can change. Things can change. I'm up here with my guitar when you guys come in, and then when you leave, I'm up here with my guitar. So some of you guys, I don't even know your names. I know your faces, and you know my name, which puts me in a harder situation than you're in when we talk, right? But it's true that there's a newness and a constant turnover and constant change in this world. Well, in this world, a whole lot of change came over the course of a couple generations. And I don't look at this church in particular because I think our little church here is like that. I simply don't want to look at it, see what we can learn from it. What can we take away, be warned about, maybe reflect upon, so that we might apply some action in our own lives? Because by looking at the dead church, we can actually find out, then what is an alive church? What's our church supposed to look like? So let's unpack these verses just a little bit and see what John is writing and see what he's telling them and what the message from Christ is about these churches. So in verse 1, he said, "And to the angel of church of Sardis write, the words of him who has the 7 spirits of God and the 7 stars, I know your works, you have the reputation of being alive, but you're dead." So as with the other messages to the other churches, and you could read about the other 6 if you want, he simply opens with a greeting to the church's leadership, the pastor, the folks that are in charge. The 7 is some symbolism, but it's just a number that represents fullness, the fullness of Christ's work, the fullness of the Holy Spirit's ongoing work in us. And the 7 stars is just a reference to those 7 leaders of the churches. He's writing to those who are supposed to be beacons of light to a lost and dying world. And he's saying, hey, take heed, listen up. Here's my message to you. So we've established what he's writing to. Now let's look at the message. I know your works. You've got a reputation that says you're alive, but you're dead. So basically, God tells this church that he knows who they are. He knows the stellar reputation of service. Maybe they have food closets. Maybe they serve in a community library. Maybe they volunteer to build housing for the poor. Maybe they have a soup kitchen, a firewood ministry. But in the same sentence, as he says, great, what a reputation, he says, you're dead. You're just dead, unregenerate. Some pretty harsh words. He has quite a negative view of reputation. That's one of the things I took from it right away. It's like, wow, I don't know that God cares much for me building up my reputation as much as he does maybe just me being a child of God and doing what I'm supposed to and finding my identity in him, not in a reputation. He doesn't look upon folks who are about their image in the community with approval. He's basically saying, hey, you do all this, but without the foundational reason for doing it, it's dead, it's hollow, it's worthless. It's done without meaning. It's a service for service's sake, and there's no love attached to it. It's a gathering of people who serve and pat themselves on the back and gain some important standing in the community out of what they're doing. It's a checklist. They've turned the grace of Christ and the gift of salvation into a list of boxes to check that makes them feel as if they have eternal security. And we are an eternal people one way or another. We better understand that it's the grace of God through Christ, his death for us, his resurrection that gives us life. Essentially, they are about religious practices that aren't connected to the meaning of their practices, to Christ, his birth, his life, his resurrection. God is straightforward in addressing these folks. He acknowledges their deeds, but basically said it's a habit. And I want to ask, have we been in this situation? Has anybody ever been in this situation? I know in the human condition, I've been in that situation. I've been in that cycle. It's not unusual. What is unfortunate is if you stay in that. And this isn't a sermon illustration. I just need to take a drink. So, have we been involved in ministry that we simply do because it's our turn? Or no one else will volunteer? Or worse yet, to boost our images in our own circles? Think about a new job. You sought it out. You were excited. You had good foundational reasons for interviewing, accepting the position. You jumped right in. And then over the years, the reason you took the job fades into the past. It's a relic of your memory. Your thankfulness, your on-the-job training, all the learning you did to become better has simply grind to a halt. It's now dull. It's the grind. You go out there out of habit and necessity. You've made some good contacts and networks, so you stay, but it's not fulfilling, and you're not really fulfilling anyone else. Well, what do you need to do in that job to reinvigorate yourself? What about our marriages? Are there times when we approach our marriages as to-do lists and habits? Are we not paying the affectionate attention we need to each other in order to be connected at that deep level that Christ connects to us? What about students here? Think about this, students. It's a new quarter, a new semester. You're ready to go. You're excited about the different classes you're taking. But 4 weeks into it, you're just writing papers. Just writing papers. Writing papers. You've lost the joy in learning. You're doing the assignment for a grade instead of what growth you might get out of it. We got to change our, if we find ourselves in that, we got to change our paradigms and say, I'm doing this for the growth that is happening within me. Not for a grade, not for so I can advance, but for the growth that I should be doing as that person in that marriage, in that job, as a student. What about our discipleship? Are we actively engaged in discipling someone or being discipled? Are we learning and applying the lessons that we learned? I just think we ought to be ever learning all the time, more and more about who God is. I think that's part of what being a Christian's about, right? Knowing our God and coming to appreciate. When I drive down to the school each morning, I see those mountains. I'm like, man, I can't get tired of this. And I'm always thinking, God is majestic. God is transcendent. He is almighty. I just take a look out there and I'm like, man, that is amazing. I don't think I'll ever lose that feeling. That'll never become a rut for me. It's just amazing. And I love this snow. I'll snow blow again tonight and I hope it snows 10 feet. I mean, I just love it. I just love witnessing God's creation and what he does in it. But perhaps it's time to move something forward, to approach an aspect of life with joy and gratefulness. Perhaps our current practice or service is complete. And we need to challenge ourselves and move to something else. You know, go out of our comfort zone a little bit. And that's how verse 2 opens. He says, wake up! He doesn't just say, wake up, snap out of it. This isn't one of those things where you're gently saying, hey, wake up, honey. It's time to go to church. This is like getting a teenager out of bed. It's like, wake up! You don't go up there and just kind of, you yank the covers off of them. You make them cold all of a sudden. Pour water on them. You get them up. And that's what God's doing in this verse. He's saying, wake up, man. Exclamation point. Snap out of it. Realize why you serve. Acknowledge Christ. Let your works be for him. Strengthen what remains and is about to die. For I've not found your works complete. They're not complete. The DMV, and I'm going to speak in general, not ours. Ours is probably great. But in general, you hear stories about the DMV. It's notorious for folks who don't acknowledge you. They're slow to help. They can be cold and mechanical. They miss the very thing about their jobs that could be bringing joy to their jobs. That beaming, proud, smiling 16-year-old who's getting his license for the first time. They just miss that. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to connect, to congratulate them, to offer a quick word of wisdom about the roads out there, about the other drivers and how they ought to drive? Wouldn't it be great, and this could be the reason for doing that, not just getting to use a laminating machine, right? You can actually speak life into the child that's there excited. But he doesn't stop at wake up. He continues and says, strengthen what remains and is about to die. This church was dead, but there were a few in it about to die. It is referred to as the dead church, but Christ was warning them that there's something that remains. If you don't strengthen, it will die. You'll close your doors forevermore. And even if you don't close your doors physically, you've closed your doors to Christ and the reason why you're doing things. And this church Christ is kind of like the hero and he's offering again that second chance. Again, right, he does. The church is like that movie, you guys probably don't remember, it's 30 years old, but The Princess Bride, where the guy's just almost dead, right? Christ is extending his hand once again. But why? Why should they pay attention and strengthen what remains? Well, because he says, I've not found your works complete. And again, there's the notion that you're dying because you don't have the completeness, the fullness of Christ as the foundation for all the deeds that you're doing that boost your image and give you a reputation, but do very little to advance God's kingdom and glorify him. We can only have works that are complete and service that's full if it's based on the foundation of the grace of Christ and what he's done for us as sinners that separates us from God the Father. He conquered that. From that point on, we gladly step out and we do our service. We do our firewood ministry. We do our missions work. We go down to loaves and fishes and serve those people out of love that flows from the most loving act that humans know, to give your life for somebody. I had neck surgery this fall, and before the surgery, the nerves that were running down my arm were pinched off from here down, and so I actually lost a lot of muscle mass. It just disappeared in my shoulder because the muscles weren't being fired by those nerves, and they just atrophied. They just shrunk up back in the back of my shoulder, and I couldn't feel my hand, and I still can't. But apparently I will now that I've had a disc replaced. It just takes about a year, and it grows. The nerves regenerate about a millimeter a day. So it's got to work its way from my neck down to the end of my thumb. So I'm hopeful that one day I will once again hit every note over there. If you guys are musicians, you hear me sometimes miss those notes just because I'm trying to control my hand. And I look forward to being able to control it all the way again, and to feel all the way again. I feel pressure, but I don't feel that sensation. But I don't want to lose that totally, right? So I went and got the surgery. I didn't just stay there with a dead arm. And now I'm on the road to recovery, even if it's just doing one push-up. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I did one push-up. And now I'm up to about 10, and that's the most. And in the Army, I do, on my tests, I usually do about 58 to 60 in there. And I need to get back to that. So I need to wake my own body up, right? And complete the work that God begun in me. How much more is it important that we strengthen our spiritual lives, that we strengthen our relationship with Christ, that we know God fully? So we have to remember then what we've received and what we've heard. We need to keep it. We need to repent. And then there's another warning. If you will not wake up, I will come like a thief. and you will not know at what hour I will come against you. So remember, keep it, repent, wake up. That's more advice than he gives to any of the other churches, the other six. He gives them four steps. Remember, number one, it's like remembering why you're married sometimes. Because marriage can become, this is a whole other sermon, I shouldn't get off on this, but I'm just going to say this real quick. Marriage can become a whole other, it can become to-do lists. Hey, did you get the kids off to school? Did we make lunches? Did we get the oil changes? Did we mow the lawn? Did we get gas for the lawnmowers? Did we go to Durango and pick up that thing that we were, did we? It can become that. And after about 15 years, you look at each other and go, man, we got to remember why we did this in the first place. Because we were crazy about each other and just wanted to spend the rest of our lives together. That's why. We got to remember why we're Christians, too, when we start doing all these busy things that we do as Christians. That first love we have. He's calling this church to remember why it was established in the first place. And what was that? And we could go to any letter that Paul wrote. We could go to the Gospels. I like to go to the Old Testament because I love to see Christ in the Old Testament. So I'm going to take you there just for a second. The book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel, the prophet, said, I'll sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean from all your uncleanliness. From your idols I'll cleanse you. I'll give you a new heart, a new spirit. I'll put it within you. And I'll remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I'll put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules. You shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I'll be your God. And Ezekiel's talking to Israel and foretelling a promise for them. And in so doing, he gives a foreshadowing of the work of Christ, the work of the Holy Spirit, that we would walk in his ways, we would be awake, we would be obedient, we would continue to learn and be discipled and disciple others. To be alive, we must have a new heart, his spirit, obedience to him that follows, and in that obedience, offering up our gifts and talents to God, to further his kingdom and to glorify him. And John, as we just read, if you won't wake up, I'll be like a thief. You don't know when a thief comes, right? Thieves are there to harm you. They come when we least expect it. They bring consequences to our complacency. In Germany, when I lived over there, if you left your wallet on the dashboard or a purse on the seat, you got fined because you were inviting theft. So it was the responsibility of the persons who owned whatever to protect that whatever. It was the responsibility of them to put their reladens down at night. There were like these shutters sort of that were built into the walls that rolled down. It was the responsibility of you to lock those doors. You would be fined if you were robbed. Of course, they're going to go after the thief too, but they're going to teach a lesson that, hey, you think about this, and then you won't have any thieves coming. You'll be set up. What a warning. We're all going to stand before God, and I want to stand before him having just a minute before been serving him. That's how I want to stand before God. A minute before my life right with him. That's how I want to stand before God. We're all going to do it. We're all going to be there. Not because of my traditions or my liturgy or my rote reading of the word or my turn at the soup kitchen or this work that I do in the army that if I catch myself becoming routine, I quickly snap out of it. I wake up. That's how I want to be serving. And I've shown you this slide before. Christian life versus Christian lifestyle. These are just some of my thoughts that, you know, what does a dead church look like? Lots of tradition and motions and deeds, a focus on social ills versus life-giving gospel of Christ, material rather than spiritual, doctrine and systems of theology versus grace and the word of God, creating an army of volunteers instead of an army of disciples. Well, it looks like this, you know.